Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Ayala, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Update on Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. And today's program is being offered in collaboration with the CLL Society, and we are delighted to have them working with us to bring this program to all of you. And this is a topic that we know is of great interest to all of you, and it's also offering this program 2 days after ASH, the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting. American Society of Hematology meeting, and so that you're going to get a lot of very new information today. That's just really important. So stay tuned. And our lead speakers, Dr. Pagel and Dr. Brown, will be presenting some of that more newer emerging treatment for CLL. On today's program, we have a lot of participants. We have over 467 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Cyprus, India, Ireland, Switzerland, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So really a bit of a global call, actually great interest from throughout the world. Today's program is supported by Gilead and Pharmacyclics, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have the best speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. John Pagel. Dr. Pagel is Chief of Hematologic Malignancies Program, Director of Stem Cell Transplantation, Swedish Cancer Institute. And Dr. Pagel is going to be really presenting a bit of an overview of CLL, and he's really going to talk about some of the newer treatments, the clinical trials available in terms of CLL. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Pagel.
Okay, Carolyn, thank you. It's nice to be with everybody today. I'm in Seattle, Washington. It's dry out today, so we're happy about that. And it is true, I also just returned from the ASH meeting a couple of days ago, and we're all excited about the data presented there. I think mostly you'll hear about overview of that from Dr. Brown here in a few minutes. And we're very excited from that data and where the field of CLL is evolving. My job's a little bit more basic here to start, and that's to provide an overview of what CLL is, how we approach it, and a big picture of how we treat it. That's important, I think, here because we do have many people who are probably joining the call who are relatively newly diagnosed or caregivers of someone who might be early in their disease venture. So just a few words about CLL in general to make sure we're all on the same page. CLL certainly not uncommon. It afflicts somewhere around 10 to 15,000 new diagnoses in the United States every year, but it's a chronic disease, meaning that people live with this disease for long periods of time. So maybe up to 250,000 people are living with the disease every day here in the United States. So it's a disease that is originating in a blood cell, and in particular a blood cell called a lymphocyte. So just like we can have a cancer of any part of our body, breast or colon or lung, we can have a cancer of blood cells. Blood just happens to be an organ in a liquid form, and most of the time we have the cancer in a white blood cell, and it's not uncommon to be in a white blood cell we call a lymphocyte. Normal lymphocytes, their job are typically to fight infections. So a normal lymphocyte is born in the bone marrow. It grows up and it might leave the house, circulate in the blood, find a place to live as it becomes a young adult. That might be in lymph nodes, could be in the spleen, other lymphatic tissue. And then it has a job to do. It might fight an infection and then becomes a grandparent, and then that cell dies. That's the normal lifespan of a lymphocyte. But something can go wrong at any stage in the development of those lymphocytes. And when it happens in a relatively more mature cell, one that's already left the home, perhaps out in the community, so to speak, that leads to a disease we call chronic lymphocytic leukemia. It means that something went wrong in that cell. That's just what cancer is. It means that the cell behaves abnormally. And in that mature lymphocyte where something went wrong, there are two basic problems. One is that there is too much proliferation of the same type of cell, meaning that the cell becomes arrested in its development and doesn't go on to make normal cells that fight infections. In fact, it makes too many of itself. So it's kind of like I always think of the white stormtroopers in Star Wars. They all look exactly alike. They're clones of themselves. And so that's why the white blood cell count goes up over time, is that those cells are accumulating in the blood. Or perhaps a lymph node gets big. Same thing. They're growing in sometimes in the lymph nodes or even the spleen, which is kind of like just a big lymph node. And the second problem is that not only do they make too many of themselves, but the cells don't die like they're supposed to. Normal cells are supposed to have a lifespan and die. These cells actually make too many of themselves, and they don't go on to die either. And that's why, again, the white count might go up, or perhaps the lymph nodes get big over time. But it's a slow process. Many people will live with this disease for many years and feel perfectly fine. In fact, it's most common that people will be asymptomatic at the time they're diagnosed. And we still, in 2017, despite all the great treatments we have, and you'll hear about some of those here shortly, it is true that we still don't treat people until we absolutely have a reason to treat them. So many people might be what we just call watched, and we might watch and wait for a significant period of time until there's a reason to get treated. And that could be years, a few years or a handful of years before we actually have to treat someone. And the good news is that when we do treat them, they'll do quite well. Most of the time, people will have excellent responses that can be quite durable. And people might have to do that off and on for many years. They may get some treatment. If there's some reason to, as I've said, disease gets put back into remission, might show up again, let's say, a handful of years later, get some more treatment. And this off and on process might go on for maybe years or even decades. And we are excited about how we approach this because we have more and more treatment options and with fewer side effects. So the treatment approaches come in essentially three major flavors. Either they're chemotherapy-based regimens, and we still do use chemotherapy for CLL in 2017, or they're targeted antibody treatments. Sometimes we might use those antibodies by themselves, or very commonly in combination with chemotherapy. Or the third category is now what's most exciting and where much of our focus has been are on small molecule targeted agents. So chemotherapy certainly has a role in selected patients. It is very important that regimens such as bendamustine and rituximab, something we call BR, or fludarabine, cytoxan, rituximab, something we call FCR, that those regimens, when delivered to the right patients, can give remissions that can be very durable and long-lasting. Those might be patients who might be a little bit younger or have more favorable features, but nonetheless, a very important thing that can provide significant benefit to patients, despite the fact that we have a lot of these targeted agents as well. Now, most people on the call probably have already heard of the major antibody that we use in blood cancers or in CLL, and that's called Rituxan. Rituxan is typically used in combination with perhaps bendamustine or other chemotherapies. But we do use antibodies, sometimes as single agents. But most importantly, we want to recognize that there's many antibodies that are in development that are very exciting as well, and some of them have already come to fruition. A major one that has is a newer generation of rituximab. It's a drug we call obinutuzumab. It is also commonly termed Gazyva, and it's gained significant favor both in combinations in the relapse setting as well as even now in the frontline setting. And you'll hear perhaps some of those combinations from Dr. Brown here in a moment. The last category, as I mentioned, are targeted agents, and those have been game changers for patients with CLL. In particular, there's something we call kinase inhibitors. It's essentially a way for us to target an enzyme or a protein inside the cell, inside the CLL cell, in order to interrupt the life cycle of that CLL cell or to induce death of the CLL cell. So it's a small molecule, meaning it has a small little chemical structure. Typically, these drugs are formulated in an oral agent, so they're pills. And largely, they've been extremely well tolerated and something that we can do in patients who might be a little bit older, perhaps even into their 80s or 90s, when we may not have been able to give chemotherapy readily to those kinds of patients. So the first one that we've used extensively has been a drug that many of you are familiar with, known as ibrutinib. It is what we call a Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's a drug that is taken daily, and it actually can reduce lymph nodes. It can actually control disease quite quickly, and people can do extremely well on this as a what we would call chemotherapy-free option for patients. It's approved for patients who are relapsed as well as patients in the frontline setting as well. And there are a variety of other kinase inhibitors. Of course, idelalisib is approved around the same time as ibrutinib. Idelalisib targets another protein or enzyme inside the CLL cell known as PI3 kinase. Details of that are probably not critically important, but to understand that these small molecules, again, target proteins inside the CLL cell to interrupt the life cycle or the pathways that sustain the survivability of that cell and induces cell death. Lastly, the other major one that we've focused a lot on over the last few years is a drug called venetoclax, which has been a drug that targets another protein called BCL2, and it's been also very important, especially for patients who have the most high-risk disease, which I haven't talked about, but in particular, those are patients with a deletion of the short arm of chromosome 17. You may hear the term deletion of 17P. So those are the three major classes of drugs, but the good news is that there are many more in the pipeline. There's some that are on the verge of gaining approval, and many of those will continue to advance how we treat patients and not only advance the control of the disease, but make them more tolerable as well. And so that leads me to a very brief acknowledgement of understanding the side effects. And what I want to really mostly stress to the audience is that if you're on any of these drugs, the most important thing is that you're extremely well educated of knowing what the side effects might be and to be educated about how you handle them if one of them were to arise. So I tell patients, especially any of them are on these pills that they're taking every day at home, that if anything unusual happens, we're going to blame it on the drug and I need to be notified right away. So if you're having any problems or something's unusual or new, your doctor needs to know. That's the most important thing I could say about managing side effects, is being on top of them early as opposed to waiting till things are problematic. So let's then lastly focus on how these drugs actually come about and how the newer ones are coming about and how we actually advance outcomes for patients with CLL. And that's through clinical trials and clinical trial participation. Now, I'm not going to have time to give an exhaustive overview of clinical trials, but what I mostly want to say is that being involved with a clinical trial in oncology and especially in CLL is typically a very good thing. Many people might think that you get randomized sometimes to what we would call a placebo or some kind of treatment that may be inferior, and that's just simply not the case. We're talking about people who have a cancer, and it would be unethical to provide a treatment to them, which was not at least a standard of care or something that we thought was going to benefit them. So we don't randomize to just placebos typically. We actually have an opportunity to provide a new therapy or a new agent or combination of agents to patients that they wouldn't be able to get outside of a clinical trial. So what I want to say there is that every patient who gets an approved drug is getting a drug that's part of a clinical, that was at one time part of a clinical trial. So just because a clinical trial is using a drug that's not approved doesn't mean that the drug is not important, valid, and certainly might be right for one patient at a specific time. And so I would encourage everyone to always ask your doctor about clinical trial opportunities. It may not be one that's right for you at the right time, and maybe there might not ever be, but it's always something that you'd want to explore, because we have now a variety of exciting new drugs that you're going to perhaps hear about that are in clinical trials. And I'll just mention briefly a couple of them. I've mentioned already ibrutinib. Now we have a second generation of those types of drugs, and one that has recently been approved, not in CLL yet, but in mantle cell lymphoma, another type of blood cancer, which is a drug known as acalabrutinib. You also might hear it called Calquence. And it's a drug that has tremendous activity as well, like ibrutinib, and may even have improved side effects or lower side effects compared to the first generation agent. Or another drug that we're all excited about called TGR-1202, which is the newer generation of the other drug I mentioned previously known as idelalisib. And again, the beauty of these is that perhaps they will have fewer side effects. But the future of CLL isn't what I've talked about. The future of CLL really is going to be what you're going to hear next from Dr. Brown, and that's probably largely a focus on what we would call novel combinations. And a lot of that important data, achieving very, very good remissions with outstanding depth of remissions, are things that we discussed at the ASH meeting just a couple of days ago. So my time's up. Hopefully I did a good job of giving a little overview, but now I know you'll all be more interested probably in where Dr. Brown's going to go. And so, Carolyn, I'll perhaps toss it back to you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tegel, and also thank you always for making the complex so understandable to everybody, so thank you, and I know it's outstanding, and there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Brown. Dr. Brown is Director, CLL Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Associate Professor, Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Brown is going to be presenting then on the new and emerging treatment approaches really presented at ASH, the American Society of Hematology annual meeting, and the very important piece that you're all wanting to hear. So I'm going to turn this program now over to Dr. Brown.
Thank you very much. Very glad to be here from a cold place, Boston, although the sun is shining today. And we're all just back from Atlanta, where we heard some really excellent updates about CLL therapy, which Dr. Pagel alluded to. The real excitement this year was around combinations of the drugs that you heard about from Dr. Pagel, as well as some other drugs. And, you know, the reason why we combine the drugs is to get even deeper remissions so that we can not have any of the disease still there that we can see, and then to be able to potentially stop the drugs and have very long remissions. And ultimately, hopefully, by doing this, we will get to cure for our patients with CLL. And so it's all very exciting. I think the first trial that I'd like to tell you about, the one that will have the most immediate potential impact on actual clinical care available to everyone, even not on a trial, was with a drug called venetoclax, which is one of the targeted therapies. It's a little different from ibrutinib and idelalisib in that it inhibits a different kind of target. It actually makes the cells kill themselves by blocking, again, a protein target in the cell that keeps them alive when they should die. And that's a drug called venetoclax. It's approved right now for people with high-risk disease who've been treated before, a very limited type of approval. But what we heard about at ASH was a trial that will likely win for the combination of venetoclax with that very excellent antibody that Dr. Pagel told you about, the rituximab antibody that we've been using for many years. And that combination was very effective when it was compared to patients getting a standard chemotherapy regimen called BR. And these were all patients who'd been treated before, and they were assigned to either get the venetoclax with rituximab or the bendamustine with rituximab. And it was found that the patients who got the venetoclax with rituximab after 2 years, 85% were still in remission, which was really a remarkable finding compared to some of our prior experiences. And so we expect that this will lead to the approval of that combination for anyone who's been previously treated with CLL, and it will represent a very good option for people. The venetoclax drug tends to be very well tolerated, just like you heard about with ibrutinib and alpelisib. It does require a little bit of monitoring in the first month or so when people are started on it. We started at a low dose and we go up slowly just to make sure that the body adjusts and we don't kill the CLL cells too quickly. But then after that, it usually goes very well. The other exciting aspect of this trial is that the therapy was only given for 2 years and then it was stopped. Many of the oral drugs that Dr. Pagel discussed, we give continuously, which is great because they work for a really long time, but it also can add up to many years, and sometimes new side effects can crop up. And so if it's possible to stop the therapy and still have a long remission, we like that. And so that's where this trial was moving us toward, with the plan 2 years of therapy and then stopping. We still only have followed the results for about 2 years, so we'll need to continue to follow that over more time. But it's just a very exciting result, and we expect that next year this will become available for patients in clinical practice. The other aspect that was very, very exciting was combinations of these drugs together. So we've all been waiting for a long time to combine ibrutinib with venetoclax. Ibrutinib is very, very effective at shrinking lymph nodes, and venetoclax is very effective at clearing the cells out of the blood. So putting the two together is like a double whammy that gets both of those two parts of the CLL disease very, very quickly. And so we heard a couple of trials presented where this combination was given to both patients who had not had any prior therapy and those who had had prior therapy. And the results were really quite impressive. We were able to give the drugs together safely, and the patients who were treated had very high rates of eradication of their disease, what we call complete remission, as well as we have fancy tests that we use now to look especially carefully for the CLL cells in the blood or the bone marrow, and that's called looking for MRD, minimal residual disease. And what we hope for is that we can get rid of that minimal residual disease, so-called MRD negativity. And so these combinations of ibrutinib and venetoclax do that very, very well. And by doing that, again, it gives us the hope that we may be able to do the therapy for a shorter time and then give people very long times off treatment and then maybe able to use the treatments again later. The other type of combinations that we heard about included combining some of the antibodies with venetoclax or ibrutinib. I already mentioned the venetoclax with rituximab, but there was also a study combining venetoclax with that next generation rituximab antibody that's been approved for a number of years, the obinutuzumab or Gazyva that Dr. Pagel mentioned. And this treatment also had very high rates of getting rid of any of the disease that we could detect, the MRD negativity, even in patients who'd had prior treatments, and kept people in remission for quite a long time. So even without combining ibrutinib and venetoclax, just using an antibody with venetoclax, we're still getting these very high rates of remission, which is exciting. With ibrutinib, we have also done a number of studies and heard about a number of studies combining either rituximab with ibrutinib or obinutuzumab with ibrutinib. And this results in quicker remissions, which can be helpful for some people if we need to get the disease down more quickly. And we're not sure yet how much adding the antibodies with ibrutinib will change how the disease behaves over time. The ibrutinib by itself is so effective that the antibodies may not add as much for people who don't need that very rapid response. But we're still evaluating that. And then another class of combination that we heard about was actually, we did hear about a couple of studies adding ibrutinib to the chemotherapy, the FCR-based chemotherapy. And this is being done because we still have very, very long follow-up that FCR can give very long remissions for people who can tolerate it and whose disease has certain lower risk features. And so adding ibrutinib to those combinations resulted again in very, very high rates of eradicating the disease that we could see. And so this was incredibly exciting, I think, for everyone to see these combinations. And as we move forward, we'll get longer follow-up, we'll get more combinations. The other aspect that we always look for at ASH is what new drugs are coming along. And Dr. Pagel already mentioned the acalabrutinib or Calquence drug that's approved for a different disease, mantle cell lymphoma, but that we will expect to get approved for CLL in the future. The other category of inhibitors similar to ibrutinib and acalabrutinib is actually we're starting to hear about drugs that work best or work particularly in people whose disease has progressed on ibrutinib that target actually the main mechanism by which that happens. And some of those drugs are moving into clinical trials now, which I think is very exciting, along with the type of ibrutinib-like drugs that have potentially fewer side effects like the Calquence. So there's two different categories of next-generation ibrutinib-like drugs. There are also some new PI3 kinase inhibitors coming along. Remember, that's another category of targeted drug, similar to ibrutinib, but hits a different target, but blocks how the cells are driven to grow and divide. Adalimumab is the approved drug in that class. And there's a new drug coming along that had what we call a registration trial, which means that it could get approved based on those results. And that drug is called duvelisib, similar to adalimumab, but has a slightly different profile and had similar effectiveness in the patients who were treated in this trial. And so that may become an option for patients in the coming year. There's also another drug in that class called umbralisib, which is coming along. And that one seems to have a slightly different profile, slightly fewer side effects, perhaps. So another, again, the emerging theme that as we try to improve on the first generation of drugs, we can hopefully get fewer side effects but still maintain the very high effectiveness of the of targeting these particular pathways that keep the CLL cells alive. And so that's a lot of different combinations. It's somewhat mind-boggling even for us, actually, to keep track of it all. But the theme is that we're getting more and more effective therapies that get deeper and deeper remissions, and the deeper the remission, the longer we expect it to last. And so the next few years, we're going to be figuring out what's the best order in which to use these, what works best together versus sequentially, and in which patients do these different combinations work best. And so that's going to be very exciting. And there's no wrong answer because everyone getting the current therapies as well as these new therapies is really deriving amazing benefit with less toxicity than we had in the past. I also want to echo what Dr. Pagel said about the clinical trial option. You know, many of these combinations that we're all excited about, you can start to get now through clinical trials. And typically, as he noted, participating in clinical trials is really very, it gives you access to new drugs. It can be very beneficial. And, you know, it moves us one step closer to cure. We learn more. We build on our prior regimens. And hopefully we'll get to a day where we can cure everyone with CLL. We really have amazing tools now, amazing drugs, and it's just a very exciting time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown. That was really outstanding. And my esteemed colleague, you also have that very wonderful ability to make very complicated topics and concepts understandable for everybody to understand the best treatment and the new treatments that are out there. So everyone has a heads up on everything that's coming down the pike. So thank you so much. And and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Brian Kaufman. And Dr. Kaufman is founder and medical director of the CLL Society. And actually, we're delighted to be partnering with him on this program today. And I'm going to turn this program over to Dr. Kaufman, who's going to talk about the CLL Society's free programs and services. So I'm delighted to have Dr. Kaufman on the call.
Hi, Dr. Brian Kaufman here, and I want to start by thanking Cancer Care for this opportunity. And I feel incredibly lucky to be on a call with such experts as Dr. Brown and Dr. Pagel. But the CLL Society is about people that are not always lucky enough to have access to such experts, and that's what we try to do, fill that gap. I'm a family doctor and a CLL patient myself, and I founded the nonprofit CLL Society to ensure that all patients get their best possible care. Because CLL is relatively rare, and what we've learned today, it's rapidly changing. There's improving treatments. There's really important clinical trials out there. We encourage patients to get expert advice and become knowledgeable about their disease, look at appropriate clinical trials, because our motto is that smart patients get smart care. And we do that besides doing these educational programs we do with cancer care and others. We provide several services, all of which are always free, and they're always CLL specific. Our website, CLLsociety.org, it's CLLsociety.org, it's full of patient-friendly information with writing from experts such as Dr. Pagel and others that cover everything from the basics in terms of what is a lymphocyte, what does your spleen do, to some of the most advanced research. We'll have new articles up from ASH in the next few weeks, so it'll be from the very beginning to the latest research, and we have links to other helpful sites. We have a downloadable toolkit which lets you help you build your CLL expert team. We offer glossaries of the complicated words you sometimes hear in CLL. What are the abbreviations and acronyms mean? We have links to experts around the world. We have normal lab values. We have a spreadsheet so that you can follow your labs. We have a section that provides the patient's perspective on clinical trials and helps you understand how to access clinical trials. And just in the last few months, we've launched a new program which provides a free online access to a second opinion from world experts, such as you're hearing today, for people who, because of their circumstances or their geography, don't have access to those experts. We also know that not everybody lives online, so we have live support groups in 24 cities across the country, and we do patient forums. This year we'll do 12 different patient forums in different cities. We also do research in terms of what's important to us patients, and we use that to inform the people that are treating us and the people who are making decisions about us to understand the data and what's important to us. So please let me know how we can help you. Please visit our website, CLLsociety.org, sign up for our alerts, get the latest news and interviews. We have over 300 videos on our website, and you'll also get my personal 12 commandments for living well with CLL, because we believe that smart patients get smart care. Thanks for this opportunity. Stay strong, because we are all in this together.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kaufman. That was wonderful, and really, it's wonderful to be working with you. And this is a wonderful resource for people on the call. Some of you are asking about the specifics of treatment and things like that, and that website, the CLLsociety.org, is a wonderful resource to get just that, what you're looking for in terms of that information in writing. So that's a great place to go. And lots of other information as well, so all the conferences and everything they offer. So thank you. And our next speaker, before we take questions, is Caroline Edlin. Caroline is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. She's our online support group program director, and she will be talking about Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Edlin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. And I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional supportive services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer care groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what all of this means for you and your loved ones. A cancer care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer care services are here to help. So please do consider contacting us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you so much for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Evelyn. That was wonderful, and I appreciate that so much. And now we do have time for questions, and we have a lot of time for questions. I want to thank our speakers and for that. And actually, and we have questions already coming in online, but we do want Ayala to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, because some of you don't know what to do, and we want to be sure everybody gets a chance to ask a question. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, I will, at the end of the call, let you all know how to get those questions answered. We're going to, let's see how well we can do, though, today. We're going to try as hard as possible to take all your questions. Ayala?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question is from Emil S. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. You discuss remissions with this cancer. Is there ever a cure, and do you have become cancer-free? And what are the specific side effects of these medical drugs on the market?
Well, Neil, thank you for your question. And Dr. Pagel, could you address that question in a general way, of course, because everyone, but if you could address that question, that'd be great.
Sure, of course. It's an important, good question. So, you know, most people will live with CLL for many years, and as I said, even decades. And if we look at people with CLL and compare them to same type of patient, same age as an example, but without CLL, we really actually think that people are living now just as long with the disease as opposed to those without the disease. But that being said, for most patients, the vast majority of patients, it's not a curable malignancy, at least not with the way we approach it today. Now, I will say it is a curable malignancy, but that's a very small group of patients who get cured, because the only real proven way we know of curing it to this point is with a stem cell transplant, and in particular what we call an allogeneic transplant, using someone else's cells as a donor. And we don't typically do those types of treatments in patients with CLL unless we have a really, really good reason to. And the reason, of course, for that is that sometimes people might have a significant problem or complication related to the transplant. And so we don't do that unless we need to, because we know people are going to live a long period of time typically, no matter what we do, despite the fact that they may need treatment on and off for many years. But to be fair, we need to continue to explore this. And I think, you know, Dr. Brown kind of really alluded to this. We're starting to ask more important questions that are leading us to curing people, and that's eliminating disease all the way down at the molecular level, eliminating what was termed minimal residual disease. And so now we can take, you know, let's say 10,000 white blood cells and see if we can find one malignant CLL cell in that whole sea of cells. And if we're able to eliminate that, maybe we're working towards curing it. And I think that's where the combinations of targeted agents are really exciting. So in general, it's not something that we work towards curing. It's something that we manage, and that leads, of course, to why we call this a chronic disease. And as I said, most people will live with the disease for a long period of time. You also asked about side effects, and you know, side effects are a difficult thing to talk about here, maybe just because there's so many different treatments, and all of them have unique side effects. But in general, most of the time, most of these agents that we use now are very good. In fact, don't have many, if any, side effects. Most people will do extremely well with most treatments. The biggest thing that we watch for are infections. So, you know, we're targeting blood cells with our treatment. And so, of course, we are going to knock down sometimes some normal blood cells, and that always puts us at a slighter risk for infection. So we take fevers very, very seriously, and infections are important to be dealt with in an expeditious manner. And then every drug has another host of side effects that may be unique to it. The new targeted agents, they typically revolve around things like sometimes some GI toxicity, so you may see some nausea or diarrhea. Some agents are, you know, specifically known to cause some of those things. Others don't. You're going to want to talk to your doctor about what your drug that you might be on or considering to go on would cause for a side effect. Other things that might happen certainly could be problems with bruising or sometimes bleeding. That's something we can see in a variety of other factors. But in general, I want to stress that people will tolerate these drugs really well, and they may be able to tolerate them really well for a long period of time. And people typically will do very well for a long period of time with this disease.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks. And I hope that's helpful to you, Emil. And please also, of course, take that information back to your treating healthcare team. Thank you. And our next question is for Dr. Brown, and it's actually two of them. They're actually both, I'm going to read both, but they're actually both very much the same, about watching and waiting. So when watching and waiting, what exactly are we waiting for? When is intervention indicated? And the second part of that from another caller is, what is the reasoning behind watch and wait? Wouldn't it make more sense to attack the rogue cells in their infancy before things get out of hand? So those are probably questions that people ask all the time, and if you could address this in a general way, Dr. Brown, that would be very helpful, I think. Thank you.
Sure. And, you know, I think Dr. Pagel gave a good introduction to the idea of watch and wait and talking about how CLL is a very chronic disease and that we manage it over time. And so when many people are diagnosed, they have very, very little disease, and it's really not bothering them at all, potentially. Some people it is bothering, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but many people are not having any problems with it. And as we heard from Dr. Pagel as well, treatments do have side effects. And so it's actually been studied where people were treated right away at diagnosis, even if they felt fine and had no definite problems, or waited until they developed certain symptoms that I'm going to tell you about in a minute. And it was found that treating people sooner didn't result in a benefit, but resulted in more side effects. And so that really sort of established this idea that we observe people for as long as we can. And sometimes that can be decades for people, as you also heard from Dr. Pagel. And so that's many, many years of your life where you don't have to deal with interacting with treatments or the healthcare system or whatever side effects might come up, coexisting peacefully with your CLL. Now, the reasons why we do start to consider treating people: one is if you do develop significant symptoms. This can include night sweats that are very bothersome. And I would note, many people with CLL do feel a little warmer than they did before or have a little bit more sweating, but it's not progressive and deeply impairing of life. And so in that case, a lot of times we'll just observe that. But if it gets much more extensive and is becoming something that is hard to live with, then that type of symptom could be something that we consider treatment for. Similarly for fatigue. Fevers, chills, can potentially be symptoms from the disease, but we really don't tend to see that so much with CLL because it is very much a chronic disease. So symptoms that are becoming very troublesome are a reason why we treat people. But one of the most common reasons why we treat people is actually if your normal blood counts, the red blood cells that carry the oxygen to the tissues start to go down, that's called anemia, or if the platelet cells that clot the blood start to go down. And many times that's from the CLL that may be accumulating a bit in the bone marrow. And so if that starts to happen and reaches a certain point, then we like to treat it to fix that, to clear out the bone marrow and let the normal cells come back to normal so that you don't have symptoms or develop more problems or need transfusions, for example. Other reasons could be if lymph nodes start to grow or be bothersome or uncomfortable, then that might be a reason why we treat. But, you know, for many people, this happens gradually over really a very extended period of time. And so I always tell patients during the watch and wait phase that you don't sort of want to watch and look for symptoms, that many symptoms that you may have are not related to the CLL. They could be related to all the other things that happen to us in our lives. And try to just sort of stop thinking about it as much as possible. We know that's extremely hard, but, you know, over time, as things stay stable and nothing happens, sometimes people do start to adjust a little bit more to the watch and wait. And then, as I said, it can go on for many, many years where you peacefully coexist without needing treatment for your CLL. And that's a good thing because we know that when you're not getting treated, typically the CLL will stay about as it's been. It doesn't tend to turn worse. And so we just keep an eye on it.
Thank you very much. Excellent. Very helpful to everyone, I think. And then our next telephone question, Ayala.
Our next question is from Heather V. Your line is now open. If your telephone is on mute, please unmute it.
No, I think that's from me. This is Allison. Thank you for a wonderful presentation. Someone in our group is asking, is the possibility of ibrutinib use causing CLL cells to increase rather than decrease? Was this alluded to? Is it possible? And is there a limit to the effectiveness of a daily dosage in inhibiting the target cells?
Thank you, Allison, for that question. Dr. Pagel, could you address that question?
Sure. It's a good question, and it's actually a very important question. So it is true that when you take ibrutinib, as well as many of these other agents, such as idelalisib, you can anticipate that the white blood cell count, the lymphocyte count, will actually go up and may stay up for quite a long period of time, perhaps several months. So why is that? Well, what happens is that when we're targeting those cells, they're actually interrupting their ability of those cells to stay in what we like to call their environment or their microenvironment, where the cells like to live, which are typically in bone marrow and lymph nodes. And so when you treat somebody initially with ibrutinib, it is true that the white blood cell count will go up, and it may go up quite high. So it's not something to be alarmed about. People will always ask, well, how do you know it's working or not? Well, you know it's working because patients' lymph nodes are getting smaller, they're feeling better, their anemia is resolving, or their platelets are better. And so that's not something that we get alarmed about, and it's not something we want to make treatment decisions about either. So the white count can stay up relatively high, perhaps for several months. Typically, the average time of where it comes down is maybe 3 months, but there are some people with more favorable features who actually will have the white count stay up for many, many months. So it's not a sign that the drug's not working or failing. It's just one of the things that happens with the drug, and it's important not to make treatment decisions based on that. I think the second part of the question was, are there limits to effectiveness of treating patients with ibrutinib daily? And the answer is yes. It is true that despite the incredible promise of ibrutinib and how much we've really appreciated that people will do extremely well with this drug for perhaps a long period of time. Eventually, people most often do stop responding to the drug. It may be many years before that happens, and there are some people that we don't know may go for very extended times and not have that happen. But in general, people will develop, especially in the relapse setting, they'll develop what we call resistance to the ibrutinib. And that happens through a specific mutation that happens in the target inside the CLL cell. So there are limits, and that actually leads us to say, ask the questions, well, do we really need to be treating people every single day? And I think that maybe was part of your question. And we're starting to ask those questions if we can stop the drug at some point, realize that people might do very well for some time, and then when the disease comes back, we'll just treat them again with the same agent. So hopefully I answered your question well, but if I didn't, please let us know and maybe we'll give it a try again.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. I think very comprehensive. Our next telephone question, Ayala?
Our next question is from Orly G. Your line is now open.
Yes, hi. I was wondering about clinical trials. My husband is now currently watching and waiting, and a lot of what I've heard about clinical trials are for patients that have tried different therapies before. So I'm wondering, how is the decision made to go with a standard or established treatment versus going for a clinical trial if it's available for someone that's treatment naive?
Excellent question. Thank you. And Dr. Brown, could you address that question, please?
Sure. So, you know, our approach with a clinical trial is generally we talk to patients about what we would consider the best standard therapy for their situation, and that depends on things like their age, their general health, what other medical problems they may have, some of the prognostic factors. Heard earlier from Dr. Pagel about the highest risk prognostic factor deletion 17P, and we treat that differently. So generally based on that, based on all of those features about a person, including also how long they've had their CLL, what the time from diagnosis to treatment is, we'll decide what we think would be the best standard option. And then if there's a clinical trial, we'll present both of those as options to the patient and talk about the both what we understand to be the reasons why you would consider being on the clinical trial. For example, what typically for a frontline treatment, you would get a novel drug or a novel combination, an extra drug perhaps compared to the standard drug. And so that carries both potential benefits, which are still to some extent unknown, but we may know something about them. And so we talk over what those potential benefits are, as well as what some of the potential side effects might be. And ultimately, though, it is the patient's decision that they feel that what they're being offered in the clinical trial sounds like a good option for them compared to the standard treatment. And that could have to do with any of these different features. It's really a very personalized decision that you make in consultation with your doctor. And so, and you know, I would just encourage you that on clinical trials, you do typically get a lot of special attention, although sometimes that's extra work, like extra visits to the hospital for monitoring, that sort of thing. And that, again, the goal of our clinical trials is to improve on what we're already doing. And that's what we're always trying to do. And so we wouldn't offer them if we didn't think they conferred benefit, but that there is always some unknowns with that as well, which would be specific to the particular situation in the trial. So I know that's a very general answer. I hope it's somewhat helpful, though, because it is something that is very specific to a given person.
Thank you, and I think it helps. Thank you for the question, and it helps anyone on the call, actually. So thank you for your very comprehensive answer. Thank you. And a question now for Dr. Pagel from one of our online participants, really about shingles vaccine. So the question is, I know the older shingles vaccine is contraindicated in patients with blood cancers since it is a live virus. I have read that the new shingles live virus is okay for patients with CL, or does one just need to keep hoping that one doesn't get shingles? So if you could comment on that, Dr. Pagel.
The question, Carolyn, was about live virus for shingles.
Yes, or actually taking, or is there a virus, is there an injection that does not include the live virus that would be safe for people to take? So the question is, I can repeat the question. I know the older shingles vaccine is contraindicated in patients with blood cancers,
right,
since it is a live virus. I have read that the new shingles vaccine is not a live virus. Is it okay for patients with CL, or does one just need to keep hoping that one doesn't get shingles? Maybe that would apply to both flu shots and everything. So if you want to just comment on the whole.
Well, right. And in general, we recommend that people don't get live viruses and if they're with a compromised immune system. So the shingles live virus would be one that we wouldn't commonly give to patients with CLL. I have to admit that we don't know or have data using it in CLL specifically, because it's always risk for reactivation of the latent or quiescent sleeping herpes virus that causes shingles. So we stay away from that. So it is true that killed viruses are very safe, and that's what we would recommend. Jen, do you have Dr. Brown, do you have an approach for your patients with the shingles vaccine?
Right. Well, I generally don't give the live virus shingles vaccine. There is the new one coming out, the Shingrix, which is the inactivated vaccine. We don't have it available yet, but I understand it's becoming available in the next couple months. And I do plan to give that to my CLL patients. But it's important to recognize that it won't get rid of the risk of shingles completely, even so, because it's been studied in people with blood cancers, but not specifically in people with CLL. And so we don't really know for sure how well it works. But since it should be safe, it is something that we would like to try and provide in hopes that it will help. But, for example, I will still use the prophylaxis against shingles in patients getting certain kinds of treatment, because we just don't know how well the vaccine will work, even though it should be safe.
That's my approach as well. I agree.
And if I can add something in, the new vaccine was approved in the U.S. only for immunocompetent patients. Since that time, there's been some data released on a broad spectrum of immunocompromised patients, mostly HIV-positive patients, and it was found to be effective. But the guidelines still only recommend it in immunocompetent patients, though odds are that's going to change, and doctors, of course, can give the vaccine, whether it's in the guidelines or not. So I don't think there's much downside to it. So I think that once the vaccine is out and we have a little bit of data on it, I think it'll make sense for a lot of CLL patients.
And does it make sense to comment on flu shots and things like that at this point as well, or is that relevant here?
Yeah, the flu shot, you should never get the oral live flu vaccine, but because it's a live vaccine, but the flu shots there's not much, again, downside to them. How effective they are in CLL is questionable, but there's not any downside to them generally, so why not get it is my approach.
I agree. Everybody should get a flu shot.
Me too. And I also recommend actually both pneumonia shots for my CLL patients as well. And again, we don't know for sure how well they work, but they don't hurt and may be helpful. So it makes sense to do them.
And I do too. I agree.
Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've really been outstanding on this program. I want to thank all of you also who queued up and asked such great questions. And I know there are more questions that we would have to stay on all day to answer all of them. So I'm going to give you a resource of how to get your questions answered. We do know, first of all, that the CLL Society has a wonderful website that is specific to CLLs. So I would definitely recommend that you visit that website at clsociety.org, where you may get some of your questions answered. Of course, we recommend you go back to your treating healthcare team as well. And I think that another resource for many of you is, of course, the National Cancer Institute. Their number is 1-800-422-6237 for any medical questions you may have, as well as many of the organizations that actually many of the large organizations like Leukemia Lymphoma Society that have websites that address the specific CLL and questions like that. But I definitely recommend the CLLsociety.org as a place to start with. And for those of you who would like to either take advantage of Cancer Care's financial assistance or practical help, or actually our counseling services, which are free, or our support groups, then you would simply call Cancer Care. And those numbers have been provided, and we will be providing you with more information. We will be sending all of you an evaluation form after today's program so you can comment what you thought of the program, topics you'd like us to offer going forward. So that's really important as well. I should let you all know that we will be offering a program on complications of CLL in June, so that just stay tuned. There'll be more programs on CLL that we'll be offering in 2018, so just to be aware of that, which is on June 2018. And I do also want to mention to all of you that we are offering a program on managing eye and vision changes related to cancer treatments, and that's happening on Monday, February 26th, 2018, at 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and you'll be getting information about that. But again, that may be of interest to some of you on the call as well. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I realize we're entering into a holiday season and new year for some people on this call, and so I want to wish you all a very happy holiday season and new year, and also being aware that this can be a challenging time for everybody on the call, so also to take advantage of any support systems that are out there for you. We've mentioned a few on the call today, just to touch base, both for the person living with CLL and their caregivers, of course. So again, thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.